Before I invite you to stand, I just want to extend my gratitude for your patience with me. There was a comment last week that this all feels a little big. Like, you know, it's like sometimes I think that's correct. And you know, I was hesitant even to do this one because I'm trying to put words to things that are mysterious, and there's no amount of, you know, contemplating, and that's what we are. We're in the area of incarnation, which immediately means we are in the area of mystery and this idea that we're going to scrape the bottom, right, of this mystery, or even the idea that we're going to explain it away with words. But I have appreciated you being patient with me as we've been in this passage for the last couple of weeks as I've been trying to unpack what is a mystery, and it will remain that way for us as Christians. But I also promise you that we won't be in this passage next week, so we'll move on. But I do appreciate your patience as we've been trying to put the words to this. So if you could please stand with me as we read this passage. We'll be in it, obviously, in the future, but not to this extent. We're going to begin in verse 1, and we're going to read all the way till we get to verse 18 together. Again, these poetically charged, I think, one of the more poetically charged passages ever written, not just in the Bible, but outside of it as well. And it goes this way: in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all of humankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might trust, all might believe. He himself, though, John the Baptist, he wasn't the light. He came just as a witness to point to that light. The true light that gives light to all people was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who trusted in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children born not of natural descent, and we talked about this word last week, nor of human decision, the word behind there, nor of human flesh or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified concerning him. He cried out, saying, "This is the one that I was telling you all about when I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.' Out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of grace already given, for the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth come to us through Jesus Christ. Nobody has ever seen God, but the one and the only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known." These are the absurd yet nonetheless inspired words of God. You may be seated. Last week, we discussed how God being born in our flesh means God embraces us from head to toe in our bodies, gives significance to our individual, physical self. But God being born also means into our flesh that Christianity is by far the most materialistic of all the world religions. There might be close seconds like Judaism. We come out of that, of course. And by materialistic, I don't mean like in the consumeristic sense, in the negative sense of that, and I don't mean the philosophical scientific sense that this is all there is, but I mean that God being born is of all the other world religions, meaning he's embracing this world, this place. Now, our age, the world that we live in, is often described as materialistic, and rightly so. I mean, that's not completely wrong, given the fact that the exchange of wealth and goods makes up the inordinate amount of our time, it takes up the inordinate amount of our, it just plays a massive role in our lives. And we in the West are surrounded by lots of stuff. So if you're over the age of 40 right now, I highly recommend you start getting rid of some of it so that your kids don't have to, right? Maybe call Love Inc., bring it to a thrift store, and it will be good for your soul. Do not be possessed by your stuff. And your stuff ends up possessing you in ways that I think we're not even aware of in our lives. But this is just half the story, because our society, in many ways, even in its materialism, is immaterial. So even in our materialistic, you know, pursuit of things, we are immaterial in that pursuit. And this was vividly captured by journalists who kind of put on display the dark, dirty secrets of the corporate world. They're not secrets now if I know them. By the time I get to know these things, they've already been exposed. But that is that our economy today is actually not driven by products. It's driven by brands. What are brands? We touched on this a little bit, but what are brands? They are immaterial ideas. Brand personalities, brand, identities. Products are made in factories. Brands are made where? In our heads, you could say. They're also made in our hearts and our desires in this immaterial, place. And now, maybe you've read articles recently on this, because this has kind of been out for a while. There are some massive sociological studies that pinpoint where we are right now in American history. For the first time in American history, we Americans spend more time alone than any other point in this country called the U.S. Like, it's the first time, but we spend more time than we ever have all by, ourselves alone. Here's the thing, companies know that. And do you know who else knows that? Politicians know this. They know that we are deeply lonely and all by ourselves. It's why there's been a shift in branding to, if maybe you've heard this, brand as personal relationship. So this is why for the first time you have CEOs of massive companies on social, like they're putting people are more important, because all of a sudden these people who have no material presence in our lives now have immaterial presence in our lives, and they know we are lonely. And so now the point is not the product, the point is how do you connect to, even though they have no material presence in your life and they don't actually care about you, we are now connected to them as if we are, and they do have presence in our lives. And there's a massive shift that has taken place in the ways in which things have been branded to this level. So brand now is as more important than ever, a personal relationship, because Americans spend more time all by themselves and they're looking for other people. Consumerism then is not what often people think it is. It's not simply people rejecting God, because people are just about material possessions these days. I think that's a misnomer, and I think it's a very shallow view of what's going on, because in many ways consumerism is spirituality. It is a way, right? Even if people aren't aware of it, it is how people pursue purpose. It is how people now pursue meaning. It's how people pursue now, given branding is relationship, it's how people also pursue relationship, even though these people have no material presence in their lives. So the crucial factor, okay, today, determining why people make a purchase today, is not the inherent quality of the product. It clearly isn't with the uptick in fast fashion, the increase of sites like Temu and, say, Shein and things like this. It's clearly not the quality of the foam or the quality of the shirt. I think my children recently had a shirt that came from one of these fast fashion sites. It's terrible. Like, it's not even good. It's like it starts to pill on day two. I mean, it's just not even made. It's made out of plastic, stuff like this, right? So it's clearly not the foam or the quality of the sneaker, right, that people are buying. It's what that product represents. It's what the image that I can say have with it. It's, you could put it this, it's the immaterial spiritual meaning that is brought with, say, such product. Now, that immaterialism and spiritualism and that's not just for products like shoes and stuff. That also belongs to the financial world, since the abandoning of things such as standards and the trading of things like debt and future money has also been transformed into the immaterial and, say, the spiritual and the impersonal. And so this spiritual and immaterial, so the material and the immaterial, these aren't like unrelated things. They are inevitable outcomes of having lost sight of the significance of the material world now that God has entered into it. So when we lose and we abandon the incarnation, when we lose and abandon the sense that God has entered into the physical, we end up reaching for extremes. We end up either overemphasizing, putting too much, say, value on the material stuff, or say we abandon the material and we start putting too much value on the immaterial stuff. This would be ideologies, enter, say, the conversation of politics and the rise of the importance of those such things in our lives. An unnamed Ugandan missionary actually put his finger on this and said, we have basically become polytheistic as a culture in the West. If you know anything about polytheism, it's where, you know, your world is sort of chunked into these different buckets, and each bucket has a god over that, and so you have the god of land, and the god of crops, and the god of storms, and the god of immaterial things, and all of these things sort of live under the same tent. They all live under the same sort of temple, and it's why even contemporary minimalism and the rabid accumulation of possessions, these things are not opposite tendencies. They actually are deeply dependent on one another, actually related. They actually are part of the same story. They're after the same thing, just differently. But throughout Christianity, this has always been a tension. Meaning, throughout Christian history, we have sometimes overemphasized that which was the material at the expense of the spiritual, or we will overemphasize the spiritual at the expense of, say, the material. We've done this with Jesus. We either overemphasize his godness at the expense of, say, his humanness, or we overemphasize his humanness at the expense of his godness. So the Jesus who is just basically God to us and not a human at all, he becomes, you know, authoritative, he's sort of commanding our worship, he's a bit distant, he's a bit cold, he can't really relate to us, he's not very, let's just say, he's lacking in tender intimacy with us, like the kind of intimacy you see in like the letters of John, for example, or the kind of intimacy that we see in the prayers of Paul. But then, you know, we sometimes overemphasize just the humanity of Jesus at the expense of his godness, and then Jesus just basically becomes a good friend, kind of like the Greek gods. He's a good buddy, or maybe a well-meaning therapist who's rich in, you know, just empathy, can sit in our pain, can hear us in our sufferings, but he can't actually do anything. He can't actually change our circumstances. He doesn't have any power to change the world or direct history or to bring it to its final conclusion. Both of these are ways in which we say make Jesus into our own image, but both of these relating to the extremes of God, either overemphasizing his, say, godness, say, the immaterial, or overemphasizing the, say, physical, tangible, these two things that don't seemingly go together. We see cultural equivalents of that today. Just think about things that are very difficult to hold together. The ideologies of power, right? Justice, law, and order, and compassion, and mercy, and forgiveness. Those things don't seemingly go together, so we end up overemphasizing one, say, at the expense of the other. But these also correspond to like personality types. People are pretty extreme in those, right? You have the sort of, you know, objective, rational, more serious, cold kind of personality versus somebody who's, you know, warm, inviting, say, experience-oriented, empathetic. But we even find these ways of overemphasizing these aspects of God in academic disciplines. We see it in politics, more on that in a moment. But the key is, Jesus is not just a sort of balance of these two things. He's not like one part God, one part human. Christians have insisted he's both. Two things that don't seemingly relate together. Sometimes people will say, well, Jesus is a little bit less than God and a little bit more than human. So like if you know like the Harry Potter stories, like we're like the Muggles and he's more similar to like a wizard, right? Or like in fantasy stories, he's kind of similar to like a centaur or an elf. And he's kind of in between, but Christians have always insisted through the creeds and confessions, he's not a like a balance of these two. He's somehow, this is what's absurd about this story, he's somehow both. Nothing about his humanity diminishes who he is in terms of where he stands, in terms of who God is and everything like this. And so this very God and very human, which John tells us was born on Christmas morn, okay, this presents real issues for us and I would say even for non-Christians alike. The first is, how do you hold those two things together? How do you hold two things that seemingly do not belong whatsoever together? How do those things remain red hot in our thinking? How do they remain significantly present in the lenses through which we see everything else? I think the Christian faith gives us these nuances to hold things that don't seemingly belong in ways that other worldviews simply do not. And any Christian, agnostic, atheist, who's ever been exposed to a Christian Christmas, like they've ever come up close to what the Christian Christmas is all about, has to have sometime had to wrestle with a baby who has unknown power and strength. Those don't seemingly go together whatsoever. The idea of a baby and the idea of unknown strength and power that sustains the universe. Anyone not comfortable with a baby who upholds and sustains the entire universe has not come to terms with the absurdity of the claims of Bethlehem. Anybody who's not comfortable with the idea of a baby sustaining all of the universe has not come to terms with the claims of Christianity. And a lot of ideologies say concerning power, I suspect, even as one example, have a difficult time holding two things that don't seemingly to go together. For example, when we think about power, we often think of it in a very shallow way. We think of it in a very linear way. When you think of power, I think of power, we tend to think of, you know, size of military might, military budget. When it comes to, you know, maybe the defense budget, or that's more meta, but when you get more individual, we think of the size of somebody's muscles, whether they've been trained in mixed martial arts. So in our culture, we also think of power as, you know, somebody who their net worth, or say their silky smooth rhetorical skills, the ability to command a room. So these are all the concepts of power that say we tend to think about. So might I again invite us to go to the manger of the almighty baby, because there's no amount of visiting that scene in that moment that you can and I can ever turn into a platitude. Those two things do not go together, and yet in our Christian faith they are held together, even though they're absurd. The second issue of God becoming fully human is, I think, to allow these two things that don't seemingly go together, the incarnation, to speak a word of encouragement and healing into the ways in which our culture tends to be incredibly polarized. As cliche as that sounds these days, this sort of black and white thinking, this sort of ways in which two things that seemingly don't go together end up actually have more in common than not. And so I thought maybe we could talk about politics today, but this is cool. We don't have to talk about our problems. It's nice to talk about other people's problems. Like, this is true in our lives too. It's a lot easier to go like, oh, we're not that bad. So I have in mind somebody else's politics, not our own. So everybody take a deep breath. We could take into consideration 2020 Brexit. How about that? So, you know, if you think about 2020 Brexit, you know, you have these folks, basically, you know, the Remainers. So the Remainers wanted to remain within the European Union. I'm going to be overly simplistic, so those who are very caught up on this, I apologize. But the Remainers want to remain a part of the European Union because they want to belong to something bigger than themselves, right? That's one aspect of it. It's also good for holidays. You can travel, and it's good for trade. And, you know, it's good to have allies. It's not like they're not allies anymore, but it's good to have allies in a big, wide, scary world, right? So you have these Remainers. And then you have these Brexiteers who, you know, they want to exit the European Union because they're losing a sense of their, they feel like they're losing a sense of their particular, what makes them unique as a culture in the UK. And if you go on Reddit threads, you'll actually read people who left the UK, came back, and they say it's not the way that it once was. And so we feel like we're losing our culture. We're losing what, say, is, say, unique to the UK, the particularities that make us special, if you will. And so often, the Brexiteers, they were labeled as populists, they were labeled as, you know, racist, they were labeled as, you know, localist or nationalist in some cases. And the Remainers, so those on the left, the Remainers want to stay a part of the European, say, Union, they were often labeled as globalists and elitists and those who are out of touch with reality. And any of this sound familiar, by the way? And our own, hopefully it does. Here's the tragedy. The tragedy is it forced them to choose between two values that I think if you were to sit down, they probably actually had more in common than not. And it forced them to choose, I think. They lost their ability to hold together two things that don't seemingly go together. And we're not talking about sin and, say, light or light and darkness. I'm talking about the global, the universal, and the particular, the local. These seemingly things that don't seem to go together, but need to be held in tension. But again, I think an incarnational view, the universal coming into the particular, it can actually hold in tension things that seemingly do not belong and can actually guide us, and I think speak some healing and some encouragement into places where people go pretty black and white pretty quickly. But I just want to go a little more deeper because God didn't just dwell with us, generally speaking. You know, when John says the Word became flesh and made his dwelling amongst us, he didn't come to dwell with us like a dog dwells with us or like an elephant dwells with us, as powerful of a companion that both of those, I guess, could be. Nor did he come as a raging storm, and nor did he come as crashing waves upon the ocean, nor did he come, say, as a firestorm or anything like that, meaning as powerful as a material, say, phenomenon each of those are, and nor did he come as just an idea or a set of principles or a set of laws. Again, we're told in this passage he came actually both as truth and grace. He didn't come as an ideology. He didn't come as any of that. When John says God was born, he says the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We dealt with that word flesh last week. But that word that's highlighted in yellow in all English Bibles, behind that word, it looks like this in the Greek. It's the word logos. And if you know anything about the word logos, besides that, it's also software for Bible readers. But it also is a word that is and has a complex, rich history within Greek language. So there are fragments all over Greek philosophy, pre-Socratic, that you can actually find this word shows up. And this word shows up in a variety of different ways. Sometimes it means the spoken word. Sometimes it means this unchangeable force that is responsible for everything that exists, right? Now, we don't know how much John knew about that word. We don't know what he thought of that word. We don't know how much of the Greek history he knew concerning how that was used. What we do know is the Greeks, when they used it, were very different than the way that John uses it. When John uses it, when the Greeks use it, they only use it in the impersonal sense. Like, it's an impersonal force that's responsible for all things. When John uses it, he uses it in a very personal sense. He tells us, John isn't saying that God came to us generally. As an idea, principle, law, something like this. Nor is John saying here he came generally as a human. Again, to reiterate, he's telling us this Jesus came as one particular person. God became one, again, first century Palestinian, Aramaic-speaking Jew. That's how he came, in the particular. Now, over time, the West have become very uncomfortable. This sounds odd to us, but the West became very uncomfortable with a personal God. And that sounds weird to us if you grew up around Christianity, because, you know, there are versions of Christianity where Jesus is basically no more than our boyfriend, right? That's about the level at which he reaches. What I'm talking about are these massive shifts. Charles Taylor, a philosopher from Canada, he breaks this down in a more complex way. But he suggests that this shift took place where in the West, over the last 200 years, we have become more and more uncomfortable with a personal God. This happened around the 18th, 19th century. As we get better with math, as we get better with science, we get better with these things. Now we believe ourselves to be masters of this place and of the natural world. It becomes a little uncomfortable thinking that there's a personal God who actually can hold us accountable. And so now we think, you know, let's get rid of the personal God so we can extract from this place basically whatever we want without any consequences. And then, as a part of that, Jesus becomes a fictional character. So no longer does he have a claim on our lives either. So over the last 200 years, by the time you get to 1919, so just after World War I, no longer are people crying out to even a distant God, a God that doesn't really have anything to do, but they still believe that God is there. That's not happening anymore. By the time you get to the middle of the 20th century, no longer are people shouting into the abyss at a distant God. Now there's this deep sense that what we live in, this is just an overall sense of the West and how people engage this world. Now there's a sense that we live in an impersonal universe. And it's gotten to the point where now we live in a meaningless universe. So what does that mean? We live in a world that still includes suffering. We live in a world that still includes death. We still live in a world that includes injustice. We still live in a world that includes things like cancer. We still live in a world that includes things like pain. We still live in a world that includes things like devastation that just took place on the West Coast, devastation that takes place in North Carolina. Here's the difference. Now that the universe doesn't really shed a tear over that. In fact, the universe doesn't really care. Doesn't care if stuff like this happens, doesn't care if a baby dies. The universe just keeps going. The sun keeps going up, the sun keeps going down. The waves on Malibu, though those houses went flat, the waves in Malibu just crash on the shore and things just continue as they always do. My point is, along with the disappearance of this particular person, we could say, along with the disappearance of God coming into our flesh, so went the meaning of this place. So went the meaning of even devastations, pain, and suffering. And now, there's no one left to be angry with. There's no one left to cry out to. So the only thing left is anger towards others, or anger towards those who are and don't think like us. If you just want to take a sort of 1,000-foot view, just watch what took place in terms of the devastation of California and just listen to both sides. There's no one to cry out to with that pain. All there is to point fingers. All there is to go after people who vote different, because there's nobody, say, who has entered in to the material. And yet, God being born in this world holds these two things together. The God who is above all things, the God who is, say, responsible for all things, through which all has been made, and the one who entered into the particular, the one who entered into this world, dirty fingernails and all, which not only gives meaning to our individual bodies, as we talked about last week, but gives individual, not just individual meaning, but meaning to this entire thing called human history and the world and the universe that we live in. Would you please pray with me? Our Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, God, we thank you. We thank you that somehow, we can't really get our minds around it, the spiritual and the physical have somehow touched and are even indeed one. God, we thank you for being born. And we thank you for being born in this place, but we thank you for being born in our bodies and for making us aware of it through your word, ultimately your son, that this place, in all of its physicality, is and always has been, including its history, a hiding place for your presence out of your goodness and love forever, offering us to be discovered anew. Perhaps this is what you meant when you told us you're the gate. And the beyond isn't actually all that beyond. But in the depths of here, in the depths of your son, God, we thank you for the scandal that this really is, the absurdity that you entered into this. And God, help us to see this mystery. Help us to reflect on it. Help us to struggle with it, to wrestle with it. And God, even amidst our rational Western resistance to it, help us to ultimately fall in love with you there and stand back in awe and wonder that what is true in that one particular place, in that one particular moment, in that one particular manger, in that one particular person, your son, is indeed true everywhere. Giving meaning to each of our lives, each of our physical selves, but also giving meaning to this place. We pray this in the name of the Father, we pray this in the name of the Son, in the name of the Holy Spirit, and all of God's people say,